Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the best breakout session of the day. That's what I mean. We want some energy in this room. I'm Jeanette Mills. I'm the Senior Vice President for Safety, Health, Environmental, and Assurance at National Grid. And National Grid is pleased to have many folks here representing our company participating in this women's conference. Yeah, I'm giving a shout out to all my National Grid folks out there. So I'm an electrical engineer myself, working in a public utility. So this discussion of the unstereotype and the unconscious bias and really approaching it a different way hits home with me. So I want to thank you for being here today. And I'm going to introduce our thought leader, Deborah Pine. Deborah is the executive of the Center of Women in Business at Bentley University and Bentley Executive Education. Please give Deborah a warm welcome.
Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me? Great. Well, I have the enviable position to be in this, leading the session after that fabulous luncheon. How wonderful was that? Were those speakers? And I'm sandwiched in between, the panel and I are sandwiched in between that fabulous luncheon and the networking wine reception. So I'm asking for your sympathy vote. Well, I'm Deb Pine. I'm the Executive Director for the Center for Women in Business at Bentley University. And I'm delighted to be here today to talk about unbiasing the workplace. And I have a fabulous panel that's going to join me and share their experiences. But for those of you who might not be familiar with the Center for Women in Business, we are really a mission-driven organization. And we're dedicated to advancing women in workplace diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we say from the classroom to the boardroom. So in addition to doing programs to help our students become inclusive leaders when they graduate and enter the workforce, we really partner with corporations to build cultures of belonging, and we do that through a different number of models. We produce curated research on key topics. We have executive working groups and roundtables, but probably the most impact we have is our corporate training programs, where we actually go in to organizations and train leaders, senior leaders, frontline managers, and individual contributors on things like unconscious bias and harnessing the power of inclusive leadership and things like that. But today, I would love to talk about unbiasing the workplace. And I thought I'd start with just a personal story or two, if you would indulge me. So a couple of years ago, my husband and I, we worked with a financial planner. And he was going to leave his firm to go to another firm. And we had followed him a couple of times. And we decided, you know, it's time for us to take a new look. So we contacted a number of different organizations, asset management organizations, and met with them. And the existing organization that our financial planner had been with assigned someone to our account, which we met with. So he came to our house, and we met with him. He was a white man, probably in his late 50s. And we had a conversation where we talked about, you know, our financial plans and what our goals were. And throughout the entire conversation, he addressed every single question to my husband. Even though it was clear the assets that were brought into the marriage were earned by me because I had started and sold a successful company. Like, it was, and my husband would defer to him, well, you should really ask that of my wife. He just never got it. So he followed up because it was his business to lose, and by the way, he lost it. And he asked for some feedback. I said, oh, I would be happy to give you some feedback. I said, you know, I don't know if you realize this or not, but you addressed every single question to my husband. And he's like, really? He's like, I just went for training on that. I'm like, well, that didn't work. I said, and even though I was introduced to you as Deborah, you called me Debbie the whole time. It's only my family that calls me Debbie. It's either Deborah or Deb. And he's like, oh, that's because there's a girl in my office that goes by Debbie. I was like, all right. Okay, fast forward to about 3 weeks ago. I'm now officially an empty nester. I just sent off my youngest to college. Weep, weep, weep. And we decided it was time to get a smaller place. So we were going to put our house on the market. So my husband and I invited a realtor in. And she came in, and we had a lovely conversation. We toured the house, and, you know, she told us how wonderful it was. Happy talk, happy broker talk is what I call that. She asked, you know, how long we had been there and where we had lived before. And I said, well, in fact, we had relocated from Connecticut. And she said, oh, And she said, why did you relocate from Connecticut? And I said, oh, it was for work. To which she said, Frank, what kind of work do you do? Literally. Literally, 3 weeks ago. And this woman, I was shocked because she was the sole breadwinner for her family. She was widowed at an early age. She had a daughter with a health, you know, like, it. So unconscious bias. I mean, were any of these intentional digs? I don't think the gentleman from UBS had intentionally meant to kind of offend me, nor did this woman. But what we see is that unconscious bias turns into micro inequities, and it can be a problem. So I've shared with you a couple from my personal and professional background. But this also happens in the workplace, right? Like, how many of you, by a raise of hands, have been assumed to be the most junior person in the office because of your gender or your race? Yes. And how many of you have been talked over in a meeting or had your ideas stolen? Right. And how many of you have been relegated to office housekeeping? Great. Now, are those intentional? Probably more than likely than not, they're not. But they are the way that unconscious bias can manifest itself in the workplace, right? So we, as I mentioned, we work with a number of corporations. And when we go through our unconscious bias training, we always go through what can individuals do and what can companies do. And we have checklists of about 33 different things that organizations and individuals can do. And today we really want to focus on what we each as individuals can do to affect change in our organizations on a one-on-one basis, right? And I'll share with you a couple of things that I do, because if you look through the whole range of things an individual can do, it's really important for you to pick the ones that make sense for you, the ones that you're most comfortable with. So I'll share with you, out of that 33 or so list of things that we offer companies, that things that I try to do within my group. The first thing is to try to be reflective. How many of you have taken the IAT, the Implicit Association Test? Okay. Oh, not very many. For those of you who haven't, it's available online. It's just Google IAT or Implicit Association Test. It's a tool which will take you about 5 to 10 minutes, and it tests your biases against, you can pick one of 25 or 26 categories, race, gender, sexual orientation, ability. And for those of you who have not taken it, please do. For those of you who have, I suggest you take it again. We make it a practice in our organization to take it on an ongoing basis. So as I was preparing for today, I said, I better go take this again. And gosh darn it, I still have a bias towards male leadership. I just can't get over it. So I'm aware, and I'm trying to be better at it. So yes. IAT, Implicit Association Test. And it takes just a very few minutes. So not only do I try to reflect on, you know, using that test, but I think, and I learned this from one of the clients that we worked with, how do you make it a daily practice? How, you know, we're doing this work every day. Once is not enough. It's an everyday practice. So I try to take a couple of minutes each day to reflect on the day. And I usually do this when I first get in the car. Maybe for you it's when you're brushing your teeth in the morning. I can't remember by the time the morning comes, so that doesn't work for me. Or it's when you're working out. And to ask yourself a couple of key questions, like, did I use inclusive language? I'm terrible. I call my team guys all the time, and I just can't stop. So I'm trying to be, my team is sitting here, so they will nod their head. So, you know, have I used inclusive language? Have I included the right people in that decision or that meeting? And who did I overlook, right? Who could I have praised more and acknowledged more? So those simple things will make you a better leader. And I think if you've gone to a number of the sessions this morning, a lot of people are talking about starting with reflection, right? The second thing I'd say is be an ally. So call out bias when you see it, and we'll probably talk about that on the panel. We do that within our team by just saying, ouch. We don't have a lot of ouches, but we do have them. So that's another way. And lastly, I try to structure our meetings, our team meetings, to be inclusive. And I do that. We've done that in a couple ways. One, we rotate note-taking and agenda setting so that no one has the office housekeeping. And the other thing, we recently had someone join us who is a self-professed introvert. And she basically said to us, you know, it's harder for me to participate in these meetings because We're a group of a lot of extroverts in my group, okay? So she said it would be really helpful for me to get the agenda in advance so that I could prepare. So we do make that a common practice of sending out the agenda in advance. So those are just three things out of that list of 33 or 35 that tend to work for me. So as we go through the panel today and our panelists share their insights, I'd love for you just to take some notes on what might work for you so that we can have impact and action. So with that, I have the honor of introducing a fabulous panel, and I would like to ask them to join us. Archana, I had to practice her name, I wanted to get it right. Gil Ravi, who's the VP of Partnerships at the Sheryl Sandberg and Dave Goldberg Foundation. Emma Lees, who's a leader of oncology discovery at Bristol Myers Squibb. And Hilary Weingast, who's the Associate General Counsel and Head of Global Inclusion and Diversity at Juniper Networks. Please join me in welcoming them to the panel. Thank you, first of all, for being here. I would love to start to ask each of you to maybe spend a few minutes talking about how bias shows up most often in your workplace. Archana.
Well, I'm pretty lucky in that I work in a workplace with primarily all women. We have two men in the office at Lean In.
Can everybody hear her?
Can you hear me? I think
if it's on. Probably not on.
Not on? Got to turn it on?
Do I have to turn it off?
Yeah, you have to turn it on.
I think it's right there.
Thank you.
Yeah, make sure.
Hello, everyone?
Okay, yeah, that's
it. Just me. Okay, got it. But I've worked in tech for the last 20 years, and so I've definitely experienced bias in seemingly kind of both innocuous and fairly obvious ways. My favorite story is when I was at Google, and I was fighting for headcount, as most of us do. And it was me and three men. And I was like young for kind of like the level that I was at. So all the three men were also much older than me. And my boss kind of took me back to the office and was like, you were pretty shrill in that meeting. And I was a little stunned. I was like, everybody fights for headcount, like that's what I was doing. And it's shrill is such a gendered word and such a gendered term. But I didn't know what to do. I didn't know in the moment, like how do you call it out in that moment? What do you actually say? It's your boss. How do you have a productive conversation? And so the work that I've done over the last couple of years and the work that we do at Lean In is really around what can you say in those moments when those show up so that you can have a productive conversation with your boss, with your colleague, in order to help educate. Like I genuinely don't think he meant it. I really think that he was a great boss otherwise, but he didn't know. Like for him it was unconscious, and for me it was really reflective on how do I show up and be assertive without being called shrill. And I think kind of led me a little bit to the work that I do today. So just like a personal story, but I think you had mentioned some really great anecdotes on how bias shows up in the workplace, people assuming that you're more junior, being spoken over in a meeting. And we've just launched some new research with our Women in the Workplace report that shows that Black women actually face higher rates of discrimination and have a far more difficult time in the workplace than other women do. And so there's a lot of ways that bias really shows up in the workplace.
Can you talk about how you should have handled that or you would handle that today?
Yeah, happy to. I think there's a couple of ways that I think I would have handled that. One is probably just asking the question, being like, oh, that's interesting. Did you have the same conversation with everybody else in the room? Or are you talking to the other men in this way? And just kind of having him reflect on like, oh, I'm probably not. Like, why am I having that with you? And that's one of the tips that I would just say is asking questions. And really having that person just like pause and again reflect on what it is that they are saying and what it is that they're doing and just teaching it as an educational moment is a really easy way of doing that in a fairly non-confrontational way in order to be able to have a productive conversation about it.
And I think an important point of that is if you don't do it in the moment, it doesn't mean you can't do it later.
Exactly.
Right? When you feel like you're more prepared and you might need to script it out in your own mind, especially if you're an introvert.
Yeah.
So there's no time limit on being able to have that conversation or that courageous conversation, as we call them.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. So I'm head of oncology discovery at Bristol Myers Squibb, and so I've spent the last 25 years as a scientist working in various different discovery organizations. I would say that we do well as an industry and also in academia at sort of entry-level PhD as a sort of equal representation of women and men. But as you sort of go to the higher levels, it's definitely become sort of more male-based. And so I think that as a as an industry, I mean, there's a lot of sort of review about why that is and how that we can adjust that and make sure that we provide opportunities for equally for both men and women. So as you think about opportunities, it's not always the most outspoken that should get the opportunities, but sort of find ways to create opportunities for different people, you know, in your leadership groups. I mean, you mentioned that as well. You know, some people are more introvert. I mean, that doesn't mean that they're less competent. You just have to find different ways to then sort of promote that.
Great. Thank you. Hillary.
And I think for me, so let's see. I thought I did it. There we go. Here now.
Great.
So being in tech, I think similar, sort of, and particularly when I think broadly, when I think about our numbers and our numbers of also women and minorities in leadership, it's not where we want it to be. I think it's a lot of seeing it showing up in how we make decisions, who we're interviewing, how we're interviewing, who we're promoting, how we're promoting. I think we're getting better at it, but I think there's lots of opportunity. And then I see it just even, you know, as I think about those roles and engineering roles and sales roles and just bias around assumptions, she's not going to want to travel. This job involves a lot of travel. It involves a lot of nighttime. It involves a lot of having to, you know, the sales guys are on the golf course or doing these things, and she's not going to want to do it. Yeah. Those are the types of things that we're trying to address.
And it's really not even, it's about making assumptions as opposed to having that conversation and saying what works for you, what is going to make you feel like you are contributing at the level that you want to be contributing, right?
Yeah. All right.
Great. So, Archana, I'm sorry, I'm trying. when we were preparing for this on the conference call, you gave me some examples of specific things that have come up in the workplace in terms of, you said, like, you've heard things like, I'd like to hire more women, but I worry about lowering the bar. She got promoted because she was a black woman. Like, share, let's share some of those stories and how we can overcome them.
Yeah, absolutely. So at Lean In earlier this year, we launched a toolkit program called 50 Ways to Fight Bias. And actually on every one of your seats, you have one card. So there's 50 of these types of cards in this pack. And what it does is that it highlights 50 specific situations of bias that shows up in the workplace. It's all research-backed. And then on the back of the card, it kind of tells you what you can do both in the moment and what you can do systematically. And I shared those two because those are the two kind of that get my blood boiling. Those are ones I've heard before. And you're just so stunned that someone would dare say that to you. As a woman working at the company, somebody telling you that they're worried about lowering the bar, you're just like, I don't even know what to do in this moment. And so for me, I really loved these cards because it gave me the tools on what you can say in the moment. I think it goes back to for the first question, which is, you know, for the lowering the bar, it's like, oh, that's really interesting. Like, why do you think hiring women would lower the bar? And it's so simple, but just in that act of asking the question and reframing what you've heard back, again, forces the individual to kind of pause and reflect on what they've just said and how it might be biased, and again, kind of like open up that dialogue. So just one is a totally free resource, but just a free resource that I would encourage you all to take back to your organizations to have conversations. It's actually meant to be a discussion-based activity to have conversations with your teams around how bias shows up.
Where can we get all 50 of them?
Yeah, they're online. So it's leanin.org/50ways or email us at 50ways@leanin.org. And it's you can download all 50 for free, and then we sell the physical cards at cost for like $35. So it's a pretty inexpensive way of bringing this to your company.
Great. And Emma, when we were preparing, you talked about a bias that you faced earlier in your career, a preconceived notion.
The story I told you guys was actually sort of not from myself that I heard, but it really resonated, and then I realized as a story of sort of self-advocacy. So as a friend and colleague of mine who said that, you know, one of the best comments that any of her managers had ever made was that he had his leadership team was 7 males and 1 female. And what he said to her is, I know what every one of those men want, you know, but what I don't know is what you want for your career. And the moment that she said that, I sort of realized, you know, that we have to be advocates for ourselves. You know, how many people in the room sit and just think, if I do a really good job and I really work hard, I will get recognized. Yeah, you've got to do that as well, but you have to advocate for yourself. And it just, it really sort of resonated for me in the moment, is that sort of self-awareness and self-advocacy has to come into the picture.
And can you talk about what behavior self-advocacy looks like?
Well, I think, again, it's sort of challenging that bias. I think it's going and you know, asking, you know, to be considered for opportunities, or demonstrating that you can do something. You know, again, being willing to, you know, step outside your comfort zone and put yourself forward, put yourself into the, you know, take a seat at the table. You know, force yourself in a meeting where you don't think you have a voice. You know, at the beginning it feels awkward. You kind of almost have to listen and sort of think about a question that you can ask. It's a bit staged at the beginning, but teach people that you have a voice. So again, there's sort of different situations that you can, you know, take in different situations, but really just to sort of demonstrate and make people see who you are.
And in the point about being in a meeting, also the whole concept of amplification, having an ally or a buddy or a partner who will help bring you out as well, is, I think, important. Yeah. The other thing that research shows, women don't self-promote. Like, if you get accolades and email from people that you work with, send them on up to your manager. Tell them how great you are. You know, women tend to feel like it's bragging, right? But it really isn't. You really need to advocate for yourself. Yeah, sure.
I was just going to add, you know, I've sometimes couched that in. For me, it's a lot of times about resources. And so I'm always very careful to have the data. But it's always about advocating about all that we've done to kind of show. And I don't know, somehow comfort-wise, it feels better if I'm showing like, okay, we need more resource, but here's all the things we've done. Yeah. You know, and so I don't know, that's always kind of felt like a safer way to do it. But I realize it's really promoting, you know, what I've done, what the team's done, to get us what we need and what we want. And it's critical, because no one's going to do it for you.
Yeah, I would agree to that. I think the one thing that you said that struck me was your boss knew what all of your male colleagues wanted, but you didn't know what you wanted. And so every single one of your male colleagues is doing this. Like, they're going to your boss, and they are telling them what they want, and they're telling them what their career aspirations are, and they're telling them that, I want to get to the next level, I'd like to get to the next level in 12 months, and how do I get there? So if you're not having those conversations, you are kind of like automatically left behind. And so I just want to point that out, because I felt like you got lost, and it's like, that is just so important, is that everybody else is also having these conversations, and you're doing yourself a disservice by not going in there and asking for what you want, or telling your boss what you want.
Well, actually, and I think jumping off there, I mean, I think, you know, the point that Megan Rapinoe made sort of in her lunchtime speech spoke to that as well, in terms of, you know, almost feeling like you need to fit into the box and the mold of expectations. So you do have to compete in that space, but we've got to break out of it as well and sort of change that expectation. So we don't have to just sort of, you know, be like men, but, you know, but you do at least have, you know, it is the reality of kind of where we are, but then you've got to be there and then take it above there.
And we all know the statistics, how women will only apply for a job if they're 100% qualified. Men will do it at 60% and say, I got this, right?
60%?
60, yeah. Well, maybe your lived experience is a little different than the research. Hillary, when we were preparing for the panel, we talked a little bit about what individuals can do, but you wanted to talk a little bit about what managers can do in their teams. I alluded to some of the things that work in my organization.
Yeah, I mean, as managers, we're in such powerful positions as leaders, right? Really making, and we've heard a lot of this today, right? Making it a safe place for people to share their individual ideas, right? To be able to talk about difference, right? To bring those different points of view. You mentioned some of it, sort of thinking about the structure of that meeting, thinking about the introverts, sending them things in advance. You know, calling people out may feel uncomfortable, but if everybody gets a turn, then it's everybody, right? It's interrupting the interrupters, you know, in the moment, stop them. Giving credit where credit is due. Making sure that people aren't talking over each other, and if it was somebody's idea, right, you've seen it, you say something. And we've done surveys, and, you know, men will respond and say, this woman gave an idea, nobody listened, 5 minutes later I said it and everyone thought it was great, right? In those moments we have to make sure that we're stopping, and as managers we need to be watching for that and call that out. I think when we think about as managers, and this again is on the self-reflection, when we think about performance and promotion and hiring, you know, recognizing those biases, thinking about, again, those job descriptions, thinking about which candidates we're bringing in and why, what biases enter into that, like I talked about before. And then in the evaluations, are we using the same standards? Are we making assumptions? Are we using the same standards across the board? And then I would encourage you, again, as managers and as leaders, sponsor talent that's different than your own, yeah. Right? You have a tremendous opportunity to do that. You know, for us, a big thing is we just actually published something on office housework, and we got a lot of I never really thought about it that way, right? It's really rotating. It's rotating who's taking the notes, who's planning the party. And I get it. Sometimes it feels enjoyable, but think about those tasks that aren't leading to promotion, right? Planning that party isn't leading to promotion. So make sure you're sharing those, right, and that it's not always the same people, even if they like it, right? It's, so I just think there's, you know, lots of opportunity. The other thing that's big that we've been talking about a lot is, and again, it goes to all the different aspects, but get rid of cultural fit, yeah. Right? It's all about cultural add. Reframe that, yeah. Right? It's all about how people can add with their backgrounds and get rid of the, you know, and call your people on it. Yeah. You know, your people are doing interviews on people, and they kind of, I just don't think they're the right fit. Question, ask, what does that mean, right? Yeah. We want add here.
Yeah.
Getting back to the meeting, a couple of companies that we work with, one company in particular, they have set within their company, in each of the conference rooms, they have a bowl of red flags. So if there's ever an unconscious bias, anyone could get bring the red flag up, and they talk about it for a while. Another company, not one of our clients, but a West Coast company, if someone is talking too much, they literally have a rubber chicken that they hold up. So, I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with injecting humor, yeah. Because these yeah. are difficult conversations to have, and they don't have to be that difficult. You can say, ouch, and people will respond. Talking about the hiring process, you know, I know that there are a number of tools out there for, like, Gender Decoder. You can run your job description through that, and it will say whether it's going to attract men or women. And I'll tell you a story. In our career services group at Bentley, they use this for the first time. And career services is about 70 to 80% women. And for the first time, after they ran it through Gender Decoder, which is a free resource, they got, for the first time, more male applications than female applications. So that's one way in terms of trying. They ended up hiring an internal person, but at least they went through the process. Anything else on the hiring process that people would like to chime in on?
Yeah, I mean, so we've been, our research site in Cambridge just opened a year ago, so we're in a very heavy build mode right now. So we've been sort of hiring over 300 people over the next couple of years. So you have to have mechanisms to filter resumes. So you have to filter based on something. But again, what I've been teaching my team, you know, again, it's a luxury to be hiring with a blank slate because you get it right. But you do have to, you know, again, it's that self-awareness of checking that those filters aren't creating unconscious bias. We all know that teams of diverse backgrounds and makeup will make the strongest teams. So you just have to sort of, and different people will filter in different ways. We all like to sort of hire people that sort of resonate with us, that are the cultural fit or, you know, a certain phenotype, because that's kind of the people you resonate. But you have to challenge the hiring managers and keep a sort of constant, you know, view on that as you're building teams.
Yeah. I was going to say, to add to that, I think mandated diverse slate. You know, you should not have a non-diverse pipeline, especially at the final rounds. I mean, somebody's got to be diverse at that final round. And it's not just about gender, but it's about gender and race. And so how are you doing that? You are all hiring managers. And so how are you kind of incorporating that into your processes? I think Hillary, you mentioned kind of establishing clear criteria. Mm-hmm. Do you know exactly how you're hiring for it? Because if you don't set clear criteria beforehand, the research shows that you will generally prefer whatever the criteria the man has. And so that's, I don't remember the specific stat around that, but yeah, there's some interesting stats around that as well. So do you have that in process? And then set targets. I think we're very uncomfortable talking about targets, but unless you treat diversity like a business priority and set targets and track targets and share those outcomes with your company, you're not actually gonna hold yourself accountable to that. And so as you're looking at your own teams, as you're looking at your companies, how are you able to influence that type of transparency and that type of accountability? Because it is hard, and We had over 330 companies participate in the Women in the Workplace report, and only six of those companies kind of like do all of these five things that establish and create accountability for their companies.
The only other thing I would add is think about your interview panels as well. And we know, we've been told by some of our, you know, by some of our new hires, they chose us over other companies because there was a senior woman on that interview panel. And sometimes it's hard, especially in ours, you know, we've got a lot of men in engineering, and sometimes we have to pull a woman from another function. But again, it's not, I'm sorry, but I'm in HR, so I can say it. You know, it's not HR, right? We can get another technical place where we can have, even though it's maybe not in that chain, but that makes a huge difference. People want to see people like them, right? So include them on the interview panel.
Yeah. That's a good point.
What about the promotion process? I will tell you that I did a panel 2 years ago, and we had the CEO of a major financial services organization, male, get up and speak, and he said, "I am the most biased at promotion time." Because men tend to be promoted based on potential, women are on what they've proven. So what's being done to eliminate bias in the promotion process?
There's some interesting stats on this that I just wanted to share. What we discovered this year was a concept called the broken rung. So we talk a lot about the glass ceiling and the percentage of women at the most senior levels of leadership. But an interesting finding that we had this year was it actually starts at that very first step to manager. And so men are being promoted. For every 100 men that are promoted, only 79 women are promoted, and only 58 black women are promoted. And so, and you're so early on in your career that it goes back to what you just said, that it's really performance bias that it's taking hold. You don't have enough years to really establish a track record. So you have systematically men being promoted faster than women because they're promoted on potential, and women are being promoted based on their track record. But again, you're too early in your career to really have a track record. So I go back to really taking a look at that first step, at that broken rung, and trying to identify, back to the percentages, who are you sponsoring at managers? How are you thinking about the men and women on your team? Do you have a promotion path for them? Is that in line with what you're seeing at the company as well?
I was just going to add, again, the objective criteria.
Yeah.
You know, have those objective criteria, the same thing, the same tools that need to be used by everybody who's going through the process to the extent you can. I mean, there still can be some bias in how you're answering, but to the extent that you make those the same, those criteria the same, you're hopefully eliminating some of that.
So I had just a reflection as we were talking about it, and it comes back to the self-advocacy. Do we judge ourselves based on productivity or based on potential? If that's how we sort of think mostly, then, you know, so...
So you're saying we should change our mindset?
Yeah. I think if we're going to get, you know, if we're going to sort of be advocating, if we're going to be, teaching our, the women as we mentor people, you've got to have the mindset, you've got to be proud of who you are and your potential and not just feel it's, you just got to deliver. You have to deliver too, but
yes,
that's a given.
And on the promotion process, a lot of companies are moving towards 360 degree review, so it's not just the manager evaluating the employee. And in fact, some of the research shows that if you are going to do that, you shouldn't necessarily have the woman's self-evaluation be part of the criteria because of what's called the anchoring effect, because women will rate themselves lower, men will rate themselves higher, and if you include that in the hiring, in the review process, the manager might be more, would be more likely to not rate them as high. Interesting, right?
Yeah.
You know, we've talked a little bit about process, but and it's easier when it's top-down, but what can individuals do? What other sort of real tackle to-dos can we do to eliminate bias in our organizations and individually?
I say individually, I would look at it two ways. One is just how are you kind of informing yourselves of your own bias, right? And kind of bringing that to your teams. And then how are you advocating for yourselves to go get promoted? So we've talked about self-advocacy for your manager. Do you all have a sponsor? Is there somebody else in the organization that's looking out for you, that's sitting in on senior conversations, who can advocate for your work when you are not there, who can advocate for you getting those stretch assignments for when you are not there? Do you have allies, kind of cross-functional allies in other groups? And you know, you generally speaking, the higher you go, you need to have cross-functional managers, not just your own manager, really advocating for you. So how are you thinking about that? So a lot of this is systemic bias, and so while we're waiting for the system to catch up, there's still a lot that as individuals you can do in terms of kind of like improving your own chances of getting promoted.
Yeah, I think networking is important. Mm-hmm. Again, is that visibility to have other people see. And again, you know, we've talked about sort of mentoring, you know, and I think different people need sort of mentors for different reasons. Sometimes, you know, certainly for me, I just need someone that I can talk to, sound off my own ideas to help me think actually what's really important for me. Some people, you know, kind of really need advice. I mean, it depends on where you are in the career and the types of mentor. But I think as you think about who are going to be your advocates, think about sort of what you need. And again, it's really... being self-aware, you know, once you sort of, you know, then you can start charting your course about where you want to go.
And I think just, again, it's about asking questions, you know, calling it out when you see it. Again, it doesn't have to be in an aggressive, I mean, it can sort of be in a light, sort of just questioning, you know, when you see that bias, huh? Sort of what you said earlier, Archana, right? What do you mean by that?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Wait, I don't think I heard you right.
Right.
You
know, gives them an opportunity to reframe, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right.
And that constant kind of reframing in a polite, respectful way. Because again, I so much of this is unconscious.
Yeah.
Right? Sort of even the stories that you described at the beginning, right? I mean, they didn't mean it.
Right.
Right? And so it's not necessarily getting defensive, but it's an opportunity to educate and just kind of, talk about it.
We actually hear that a lot with the cards. Like, men actually do appreciate that in a sense of there is such a blind spot and nobody wants to be kind of walking through life feeling like they're just, they keep like not getting it right. And so I think one of the situations that we had was around asking about a woman's family. It's actually illegal to ask about a woman's family, at least it's in California. I don't know if it is.
Just as part of the interviewing process?
As part of the interview process.
Right.
Yeah, you're not allowed to ask about her kids and all of that
right.
because women are obviously terrified that you're not going to hire them if they have a family. And I was running this workshop and there was a gentleman in the room being like, oh, I always ask about that. It's how I get to know them. And it's like, I have a family. I love my family. And so it's what I use to connect. And like, I legitimately had no idea. So here's someone who's thinking they're doing the right thing by trying to connect with an individual who they're interviewing. And meanwhile, the woman is like, oh my God, you're not going to hire me for this finance company because I have two children. And you're asking me to talk about that. And so, you know, sometimes I think it can be uncomfortable to give this feedback, but I think recognizing that at least what we've seen is that men and women actually, I mean, I'm talking about men, but actually women, we all do this as well, want the feedback because it is, especially if it's in a blind spot, to kind of help them grow.
Well, I think it's really kind of interesting that you're talking about that in the hiring process, but isn't once they've been hired, isn't that part of what we say we should do is get to know people so that they can bring their whole selves to work?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
And maybe it's different once you're kind of like in the in the space.
Right.
But, yeah.
Emma. So I had just a comment about sort of feedback. So Archana brought back the, you know, the comment, which is a really good diffuser. Again, when someone says something that is just, I cannot believe they just said it. It's like, to explain, that's interesting perspective. So that really, I mean, that was, I've used that in a cover and very successfully. The other tip that, you know, and you said you had the red flags, another tip that I was given that I do use as well, because sometimes you're not necessarily trusting your own reaction. You kind of just say, really? But you sort of don't want to like react on the spot, is, you know, write it on a post-it. Put it in your office and, you know, have your post. And so then when you've sort of diffused and thought about it, then go and address it with the person that did it. And so then you don't let it fester because, you know, I mean, you know, women don't let things go right off the right. I mean, it sort of builds as that sort of builds. And so it's a really good sort of, you know, way of sort of making sure that if something did upset you, that you've got it on a post-it and that you go and address it. And I use that quite frequently to good effect.
That's great.
Hillary, did you?
No, I mean, I think you said it earlier, too. I mean, you know, just in my role, I've gotten called and like, is it okay to say it after? I didn't feel comfortable saying it in the moment, but like I wrote it down and should I go back and say something now?
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
There's power in that. And again, and it's the how you do it. But yeah, don't let it go.
Yeah.
Any other tips or topics that you think that the audience, before we move to questions and I ask you for final thoughts, that you would like to share?
You know, I would just say there's data out there now that sort of gives us sort of this, you know, that this unconscious bias does lead to disengagement. You know, it does lead to alienation. It leads to people leaving. I mean, again, there's statistics on, you know, they're 3 times more likely to leave within the year. You know, we've done engagement surveys and seeing the link between people's level of engagement and how they've answered the questions about whether they think everybody has a fair shot, whether they're respected. You know, there's power in that data. And then we also have numbers now, right? Financial numbers on this. You know, I mean, Gallup tells us that $450 to $550 billion a year companies are losing on the disengagement. Numbers can be powerful, and I think it helps us reframe the question from, you know, or thinking about this from doing what's right to doing what's right for business. And I think it's just another tool to sort of get people's attention on why we need to think about it differently.
Yeah. Just to add on the data, I think, you know, as everyone in this room, you can feel like, oh, I'm just a manager, like, what can I do? And then to reiterate a point that I think you had made earlier is that as managers, you do have a lot of power and a lot of agency. Employees look to managers to actually call out biased behavior. I think the data shows that only 27% of employees feel like their managers call out biased behavior, but both men and women are more happy, are more engaged, are much more likely to stay when managers actually do this. So your employees are watching, and they're really looking to you for guidance around what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And so if you're not helping to bust the bias in the moment, they'll take that as a lead that's saying that they can't either. And I think to echo what Hillary is saying, like, that does lead to more disengagement than you would imagine.
As well as being open to feedback and asking for feedback and making sure your people know that if you have a bias, you want to know about it.
Exactly.
Like welcoming that, making it a safe space.
Yeah, I mean, we have to set the standards. Yeah, and I mean, as you say, I mean, the data says that, I mean, people stay or leave because of managers, you know, more than necessarily what's
71%,
happening.
71%, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible, right? Okay. So I think it's important. And again, I think, you know, one thing that, again, sort of reflecting back to sort of the lunchtime conversations, you know, I think, you know, there is such a growing momentum of the female voice and the recognition of how important this is. So, you know, things are shifting, but there's the recognition that we're a long way from really being where we should. You know, if the U.S. women's team can't kind of get equal pay, then, you know, that's
unbelievable.
And so, you know, don't be a victim, right? I mean, it's going to take time.
Yeah.
I mean, so we have to be voices, but you have to be realistic that it's not all going, it's not all settled. So again, you have to be a self-advocate because it's going to take time to get there. We're all on a journey. We can all help each other, but it's not a perfect world.
Yeah, I guess one last thing to say is that, and just to reiterate something I said earlier, which is the women of color on your teams are probably having a significantly more worse experience than you are realizing. And I think that is something that came through in the data that for us was pretty, I guess it wasn't surprising. I think the vastness of it was. And so just, I would just pay closer attention to that because I don't know that that's gotten enough attention. Especially, again, as managers, as the folks on your team, is just really thinking about the experiences that the women of color are having.
So final takeaways.
Oh, final takeaways. I think for me, I mean, my shameless plug is take a look at the cards.
Sounds like a wonderful resource to me.
It's a completely free resource and a great way to get started in terms of having these hard conversations. And then the second is just do something. There's no such thing as perfect in terms of what needs to be done. Is just do something. Call out one bias on Monday or tomorrow, Friday. Call out one bias tomorrow when you see it happening to you, when you see it happening to someone on your team, and just use that as a foundation to go from there.
Emma?
I think my comment is like no one is perfect. Be proud of who you are. Really just, you know, and go and be a self-advocate for yourself.
I think for me, I like what you said. I mean, to me, it's a journey. It's not going to happen all at once. And kind of give credit, you know, acknowledge the small steps because they make a big difference in the long run.
And for me, it's as I started out, which is do the ones that are most comfortable for you and do them often and then expand what you're doing. So, well, thank you. We're going to open it up to questions. I think we're going to invite Jeanette back.
Okay, what an amazing panel. Wow. I mean, I'm sitting there going like, yeah, I agree with that. You're right. That's how I felt. So I'm going to start, before we actually open up to the mics, can I ask a question, if that's okay?
You're allowed.
Thank you. So You know, say that there's a person, a woman of color, for example, who feels like they've been, you know, using a lot of tools and techniques that you've talked about today to try to advocate for themselves, to try to make sure people are more aware. What advice would you give them if they're really thinking that they need to move on? Like, would you ask them to stay? What would you talk to them about if they came to you and they're thinking about leaving the company?
I have.
That's tough. Yeah, I'll agree with the HR person.
You're like, give me some names.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd really probe. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd kind of work with you to see if maybe. I mean, sometimes it's hard to do it alone, right? So, can we think about it a different way? Can we tackle it a different way? Are there other conversations we can be having maybe with other people? Mm-hmm. I have to say, though, and I don't know who's in here from my. I mean, at some point. You know, I respect people's individual decisions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure they're thinking it through with all the information and that we've tapped all resources we can. But ultimately, you get to decide. And again, it's my job to help make sure you have all the right information and we've tried everything we could.
That's a great answer.
No, I mean, I would second that. I mean, you know, I have conversations all the time as people are sort of wrestling with, you know, is this the right career for me and I'm not getting promoted or inside or outside as people are looking at career advice. And yeah, I mean, it's looking, yeah, have we considered all the options? What is the data? And it's really helping someone sort of think through what's best for them. And sometimes what's best for them is to stay with the company. And sometimes it's really, you should go and do something else. I put myself into, people are more important than the job. And so whatever we can do to help people.
All right, great. So we've got a line of folks wanting to ask questions. So we'll start here and maybe alternate.
Too short for this. Hi. Thanks so much. That was awesome. I have a question kind of more specifically, I guess, towards your point about educating. For me, I was born with one hand, and I feel like I'm constantly educating. It's always my job to teach people. And I think a lot of people can identify that. If you're not status quo, you know, whether you're wearing hijab or if you're wearing natural hair, whatever it is. My question is, especially more on the education part, how do you balance that? Because you have to educate and you have to put yourself out there, but at a certain point, like, what is a resource that you can go to? Do you look to your managers to explain that? Because it gets tiresome, I'm sure, I'm sure anyone can.
Emotional tax, it's called.
It's not fun.
No, I mean, I can imagine that can be a lot. I mean, the one thing I would say is, like, do you have allies within your workspace? And so can you kind of, like, tap certain people who are in the room frequently who can help to educate on your behalf, who kind of know you, know your story, and can also kind of be an ally for you in that moment?
And I would say, I mean, we try to do a lot of educating just broadly, putting tools out there, resources. And part of why we do that is we hope that you or people who are experiencing can kind of come to us and ask us for help, too, sort of in HR and in diversity and inclusion, right? So that you don't have to do it alone. I mean, and that's the culture we're trying to build.
Yeah.
It's hard in the one-off and the whatever, but there are, you know, in the situation and in the moment. But I think that, I mean, I would hope, and certainly what we're trying to foster is a greater culture and trying to do some of that education. My team will sometimes say to me, God, we're putting all this stuff out there. Does anybody care? Is anybody reading it? You know, and we're measuring that. And again, a couple of people, and it makes a difference. You know, we've had people write us back and say, thank you. Like, this is articulate. This is what I couldn't say. Or I can now take this piece of paper and give it to my manager instead of having to say that myself. So lean on, you know, lean on others, you know, lean on departments, lean on, you know, so you don't have to do it all yourself. It's a lot to take
on. It's a lot,
Yeah, and I mean, sometimes, often when we bring people in, we have a buddy system so that when someone new comes in, they have a buddy that sort of, you know, within the organization that sort of networked. And, you know, maybe things like that can help as well so that, you know, you're not having to sort of teach everyone, you know, whether, you know, whatever your, you know, situation is.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Yeah, thank you.
Good afternoon. So oftentimes I hear from companies, and it might include it, about diversity representation is we're working on it. We're not there yet, but not so much like what is the goal? What is the end state? Yeah. So my question is two things. Are there any companies that you've come across that have a healthy diversity representation from a leadership perspective? And then the second point of that is, you know, what would that look like, or what does that look like in your words?
Like, what does that look like in terms of, like, what does a healthy company look like? What do those numbers look like? Or what does... You know, I think it varies by kind of, like, industry. I mean, from a gender perspective, it's, like, it's 50-50, but if you ask me, or, like, 60-40 on the other way. But it is, you know, you kind of have to... Companies are where they are. And I think companies are trying to make progress. And, like, yes, while progress is happening slowly, I think what companies should be doing but are not doing is actually publishing the data in a way that's accessible to all employees and publishing the targets. And I think that is will be very different for each company, again, based on where they are today. And many companies are still far too uncomfortable with doing that right now. So from that point of view, I would kind of, like, push the company to start to share that information.
Just so a key point. So with certain companies, it's a catch-22 because if the diversity numbers aren't full enough, then they can't publish that data because it like at a certain level, it kind of you start to single out certain people, so you kind of can't like show that data. So it's like over here or over there type of deal.
Yeah, I think it's a very challenging. I think you kind of like push it as far as you can,
okay, yeah.
And then kind of like, and then as the numbers increase at the senior level, you can kind of keep going on.
Yeah, I mean, you raise a good question in terms of, so how long should it take? Right. I mean, again, you know, there's a reality.
Taking too long.
Right. I mean, because everyone recognize we need to get there.
Right.
You know, but we all recognize you got to hire the best talent. You know, to your point that, you know, to be diverse doesn't mean you're going to compromise, but you can't just suddenly sort of, you know, fire, you know, half your people tomorrow and then hire.
Yeah.
So you've kind of, so how do you, you know, how do you get there? And how do we, as hiring managers actually kind of set ourselves realistic goals? You know, it's kind of easier for people like myself that have just been sort of, you know, hiring because I can make that a criteria as I start. So I haven't got to, you know, try and sort of clear up, you know, bad practices.
And then even if we do have diversity, there's the inclusion part, right?
Which is really... I was going to say, when you ask sort of the question about how do we measure success, I mean, to me, I think about it on the inclusion side.
Yep.
Because we're never going to get the diversity if we don't have the inclusion, that people want to be there and feel like they can bring their whole selves. And so that's really kind of what are we doing day to day to make people feel like comfortable and want to be there and as if they're valued and belong.
This is why I love your comment about culture, Ed. It's because there's, you know, we talk so much about sort of culture and do they fit within the culture, but I think putting that ad is really brilliant because that's what we should be doing.
Okay, let's maybe go on to the next question. Nur?
Perfect segue, actually. I wanted to touch upon the cultural fit versus cultural ad. And for an organization that is maybe trying to transition from that cultural fit model, which has been traditional, to the cultural ad, I feel sometimes there is some difficulty, especially if there isn't a lot of existing diversity, because hiring managers like to say, oh, I want someone like Bob, I want someone like Blake, right? Because they're a superstar and I just want more people like that. So can you speak to how organizations may be able to make that transition on the candidate assessment process?
So I think it's hard. again, I like to use data and numbers when I can. You know, I've been at companies that have gone through a lot of transition, and we may not always be at a place where we're hitting it out of the park. So I try to use that to say, it hasn't necessarily been working the way we've been doing it. And so while you think that maybe hiring like Bob or Jack is really, you know, let's try something different, I'm not suggesting that that's easy, that's going to get there. But I think it's, again, what you said earlier, sort of getting the momentum from others to say, hey, we want our slates to be broader. We want to at least have a few diverse candidates. And it's funny, we were talking about this morning on my team. You know, I just got to get them in through the door. Like, I just got to start to get them used to seeing these folks. And again, they still have to go with best talent, but they're not even used to how to interview or that's. So it's a journey. But I think it's, you know, use what you have to get people to think about why different may be okay. And just keep pushing on it.
One company that we work with, which is a large organization, one technique that they've used is they used to go to, I think it's 19 different colleges. Now they recruit from 170 different colleges.
Wow.
So, I mean, talk about opening up the candidate pool that, you know, you're not just recruiting from your alma mater, right?
Yeah. Right, and that's the other thing. I mean, we've looked at different ways to hire, and you know, that takes more work, but we're really trying to, again, just more to get more visibility to try.
Well, the thing that was interesting for me when I was sort of working at a small biotech, and I mean, you're seeing LinkedIn, I mean, you know, like, you know, every post is the small biotech with this wonderful culture and things like that. And, you know, what we faced at that company as it got bigger was we were hiring, you know, more people. And there was a sudden panic that we were going to lose our culture, right? And I think what they didn't realize, you know, kind of reflection, is that the culture became non-inclusive. Because there were people who didn't feel part of it. Like, if, you know, if I don't go to Beer Hour on Thursdays, then I'm, you know, I'm not going to hang out with the CEO and I'm not going to get promoted. So you have to kind of be really careful with culture in terms of how you use. That's why I like the culture ad, because that's inclusive rather than, you know, rather than making sort of people all feel that they have to wear the same color if they're, you know, to be part of the company. So it's delicate, because culture is different for different people.
And there's, again, depending on where you are, I mean, again, we're going through transition. We need different skills. You know, I try to get my executives to talk about, when they talk about transformation, to talk about, okay, that requires something a little bit different. That includes the people, right, with different backgrounds, right, because we need those different skills.
Yeah. And also even talking about it as skills. We were trying to hire a business analyst for the team, and for me, my unconscious bias came up as like, oh, I want a consultant or an investment banker with 2 years of like experience. I didn't actually need that. What I needed is someone who understood Excel and understood numbers. And so when we opened up the aperture, I got a much more diverse candidate pool than when it was just so narrow. So even in doing the work, you know, we all still have the biases, but yet when we talk about the skills and the experience, it's really getting to the root of like, what are we actually looking for? And are we just being biased in terms of limiting either what colleges we're recruiting from or what careers we're recruiting from that also traditionally have had some biases in them as well?
Wow, what rich conversation. So I know we have folks in line, and hopefully the panelists will stay with us after the session's over, but we have time for one more question, so I'm going to turn it over.
Hi there. So I switched industries about 3 years ago into software sales, and it's very male-dominated. Since I've been there, I have kind of developed a little bit of a fear of unconscious bias, whereas before I didn't really have that, to the point where sometimes I might have a criticism or feedback that I don't want to give because I see unconscious bias so much towards other women. So I guess what recommendations do you have for women like myself who might sometimes silence themselves or lay low in fear of saying something, like you said, you use the word shrill. Sometimes I fear of coming off as, you know, a bitch if I say something a little too aggressively, whereas a man were to say it, it may not feel aggressive. So what recommendations do you have for fear of unconscious bias?
When you say fear of unconscious bias, are you saying like fear that you're being biased towards other people, or fear
that
others will have bias towards you?
Yeah, something that I say may come off shrill, like you, the term you used was a perfect example. Yeah. I prevent myself from maybe speaking up because I have that fear that people will view it.
Yeah.
That way.
I mean, it's my advice, but like, don't have the fear, which is like such an easy thing to say, but try to put the fear aside in a sense of you can't hold yourself back because of how you fearing others will be perceiving, like will perceive you, because you will not show up as yourself at work, and you will, I think you're doing yourself a disservice in doing that, which is like, I admit, very much easier said than done. But I think you'll learn how to navigate some of those things if you let yourself kind of like open up and actually just be a little bit more of who you are, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think the word I've often heard is, you know, well, she was a bit aggressive.
Right,
and I mean, that's, you have to be,
yeah.
Right, and so, you know, but again, it's maybe it's just sort of, you know, how you, again, it's, you know, you should never react in the heat of a moment anyway, whether you're female or male. So I think it's just, you know, it's being firm, being hard, but you can't sit back.
Yeah.
And it's scary. I mean, I would say also like baby steps.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You're scared, so try something.
Yeah.
And see what reaction you get. You know what I mean? I mean, you're afraid now and you don't know what reaction you'll get. You're assuming. You know, we talked earlier about the allies. You know, try to find those allies to kind of talk through some of it, to sort of, you know, gauge sort of how, again, maybe do it in a room where you know you've got some allies, you know, who can then be sort of standing up for you and back you.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'd be interested in, I mean, we're all human and their reactions. And so, you know, I mean, I've done things like, shouldn't have reacted like that. But,
thank you.
So we've walked that.
No, totally.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I just want to say this. I've been to a lot of meetings, and I just want to say out loud to you, I
So with that, I'd like to first thank this great panel that we've had today. I mean, I learned a lot myself and have been working over 30 years. So thank you so much. Let's give them a round of applause.